This episode with Dr. David Brownstein was an eye-opening conversation about iodine. Now, I thought I knew about iodine, but I didn't know the important healing and health benefits of iodine. And before we start the episode, I have a favor to ask. It is our mission on this health podcast to spread the message of root cause healing. That means the food that we eat has the power to heal disease. And you can help with this mission by hitting the subscribe button, because I think we know that big food and big pharma, they're most likely not going to help with this mission, but we can change that. And over the last year, we have grown to over 230,000 subscribers, but I think we know there are millions more people that need to hear this message. Thank you. Dr. Brownstein, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Rena.
Many people follow a healthy diet and exercise as a way to prevent disease and also achieve optimal health. But what if we're missing one very important nutrient that is a leading cause of thyroid disorders and potentially cancer? Well, this nutrient is iodine. And Dr. Brownstein, you tested about 10,000 patients in your practice, and most of them are iodine deficient without even knowing it. So today, Dr. Brownstein is going to talk about iodine, the warning signs that you need to know of low iodine, and most importantly, how much you need for optimal health. But Dr. Brownstein, my first question is, what is the biggest problem in the body that low iodine causes?
So we have tested, you know, thousands and thousands of patients, and what we found is over 97% of people are iodine deficient, the vast majority significantly iodine deficient. And really, unless they've seen my lecture or read my book or seen someone else talk about iodine, patients are deficient in iodine because they're not taking it. And so it's a modern day epidemic right now. And so iodine, every cell in the body needs and requires iodine. It's an essential element we can't live without. All the hormone glands, which include the thyroid, the ovaries, the uterus, the breast, the prostate, the pancreas, concentrate iodine against a gradient. So we're designed by our maker to get adequate amounts of iodine in our diet so these hormone glands can work well. So everyone knows, maybe has an idea, that the thyroid gland utilizes iodine to make thyroid hormone. You can't make thyroid hormone without iodine. And the thyroid gland has the highest concentration of iodine, but it's not the highest amount of iodine. The highest amount of iodine is in the muscles and the fat of the body. So when the thyroid gland makes thyroid hormones such as T4 and T3, the inactive and active thyroid hormones, the 4 and the 3 refer to iodine atoms attached to the thyroglobulin molecule. So if you don't have enough iodine, you have a chance of making insufficient thyroid hormone. But it's not just thyroid hormone, it's adrenal hormones, it's sex hormones, it's ovarian hormones, it's testosterone, it's pituitary, hypothalamic. All those glands have a mechanism to concentrate iodine into the gland, you know, and it's an energy dependent process. And, you know, we're set up that way because iodine's main job in the glandular tissue, which again is the thyroid, ovaries, uterus, breast, prostate, pancreas, is to maintain the normal architecture. So if I call this the normal architecture of the glandular tissue, and iodine deficiency, one of the first things that happens in the glands is you start to get cysts forming. And it can be thyroid cysts, it can be ovarian cysts, it can be uterine cysts, it can be pancreatic cysts. If it goes on longer, the cysts become hard and nodular. If it goes on longer, they take a hyperplastic appearance. If you take a tissue biopsy and look at it under a microscope, this is a precursor to cancer, which is the end of that, which is the end of this continuum. This has been shown in animal test tube and human studies. And in animal test tube and human studies, iodine's been shown to be able to halt and reverse this pathway back to a normal architecture of the glandular tissue. In the U.S. right now, thyroid cancer is the fastest growing cancer. 1 in 7 women have breast cancer. 1 in 7 adult women in the U.S. have breast cancer. 1 in 3 older U.S. men have prostate cancer. We have pancreatic cancer, ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, growing at epidemic rates right now. We all know somebody with pancreatic cancer now, where in my training days when I was young, you know, 30 years ago, the only people that got pancreatic cancer that I saw were older patients or alcoholics or drug abusers or something like that. Now I'm taking care of people with pancreatic cancer in their 40s, taking care of men and their prostate cancer in their 40s. I never saw that 30 years ago. I'm taking care of teenage girls diagnosed with breast cancer. I'm going to funerals with girls in their late 20s and early 30s dying of metastatic breast cancer, something I never saw 30 years ago. And I think that iodine deficiency may not be the only cause of this, but it's a huge piece of that pie of, you know, why people are getting these diseases. And I think that unless we recognize this, unless we deal with it, we're bound to keep repeating the same problems we're having right now. In the U.S., iodine levels have fallen over 50%. And the U.S. is no different than most other Western countries out there. In the U.S., iodine levels have fallen over 50% over the last 40 years. And during that same time, we've seen this explosion of glandular problems, from autoimmune disease in the glands to cancer. And, you know, it's been my premise for 25 years that iodine deficiency is the leading cause of, you know, what's driving all that.
Absolutely. I wanted to focus on the patients that you have seen in the last 30 years in your practice. You mentioned a lady, 28 years old. She got metastatic cancer. Can you tell us more about that and how perhaps iodine deficiency was related to that?
So, you know, just as I mentioned before about this iodine continuum with normal architecture down to cancer, you know, and iodine deficiency, as the iodine levels have fallen, you know, our rates of all these glandular cancers have gone up. So, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I didn't see young ladies in their teens, you know, they're girls, you know, at that age. I didn't see young ladies diagnosed with breast cancer until, you know, breast cancer 30 years ago, you were diagnosed, maybe the earliest was 50 years old or 50s, but they were diagnosed in older women. Now, you know, I just went to a funeral, you know, not too long ago of a girl in her late 20s who was diagnosed around 17 or 18 and developed metastatic breast cancer. And it's a mess. I've seen patients who have these growths in their glandular tissue. Doesn't matter what gland, thyroid, ovaries, uterus, breast, prostate, pancreas. When we put them on iodine, we correct iodine deficiency. Many times these growths, either they stop increasing in size, and if they're younger, these growths can shrink down to, you know, they can go away. I've seen thyroid nodules, you know, go away. I've seen breast nodules and breast cysts. There was an autopsy study of U.S. women done at two time periods, one in the 1950s and then repeated again, in, I believe, in the 1980s. And what they found was in the 1950s, 3% of U.S. women on autopsy had fibrocystic breast disease, which is a precursor to breast cancer. And by the 1980s, it was up to 88%. So something is driving this change and is driving it across the country and it's driving it across the Western world. You know, the U.S. is a big country from east to west and north to south. For something to be driving this, it's something we're all either exposed to, we're all deficient in, or something they're putting in the water supply or the food supply or something like that that's doing this to all of us at the same time. But iodine deficiency could explain, you know, these major problems that we're having.
Absolutely. It's not just iodine. There's other things that we're going to talk about as well. Fluoride, salt, all these things that are important minerals in our body. When we are deficient in these nutrients, our body causes inflammation. So it's not just about what you're eating. It's not just about the exercise. My question for you is, before we talk about more about what is iodine, the warning signs, for you, Dr. Brownstein, you are an incredible doctor, a holistic doctor. How did you get interested in holistic medicine as opposed to conventional medicine?
You know, I didn't start off this way. I had no holistic leanings. I didn't grow up in a holistic household. We didn't eat holistically. We didn't take vitamins. Basically, grew up in a conventional household. And when we were sick, we went to the doctor. If they prescribed something for us, we didn't question it. We took it. We didn't question anything in my family. And I didn't go to med school questioning things. I went to med school to sort of model myself after my family doctor. My dad was really sick when I was growing up. And he had his first heart attack at age 40, his second heart attack at 42. And over the next 20 years, it was just like this downward spiral with my dad. Now, he never took care of himself. He smoked. He could eat like the best of them. He was overweight. He never exercised a day in his life. And my dad was overweight. And he had continual angina for 20 years. And when I was coming out of my residency and ready to start practice, I basically just wanted to be a family doctor modeled after my family doctor. I went to him as a kid because I had asthma. I had severe asthma as a kid and numerous trips to the emergency room. And I was certain I knew how I was going to die when I was young. I figured I'd die with an asthma attack. And so I thought my family doctor, I was always fascinated by medicine and science, and I just wanted to model myself after him. And so I, you know, did a family practice residency and then went into family practice. And I was straight as an arrow. I didn't deviate from anything. And I thought I was taught everything that I needed to know. And really what I was taught was how to diagnose pathology and how to prescribe the one drug to treat that pathology. But I thought that was the bomb, and I thought that was the way to go. And, you know, I had patients ask me about vitamins or minerals. My mother-in-law, she was into this well before I was, and she was getting newsletters from Adele Davis and some other people who were talking about supplements and why you need to supplement. I remember telling her that she's just making expensive urine and you don't need that stuff. And she never let me forget that, let me tell you. So I was about 6 months into practicing conventional medicine. And my turning point came when I had a couple of nights of sleeplessness for some reason. And because I wasn't sleeping great for a couple nights in a row, and I didn't know why, I was in this busy family practice office. I was negotiating in to buy in as a partner. My wife was pregnant with our first, was due in a couple of months. And I thought, this is all I wanted to do in life, you know. So after a couple of nights of not sleeping, I getting up and getting ready to go to work, and I blurted out to my wife, I don't want to be a doctor anymore. I never said anything to her about this before. She met me when we were 18 years old. This is all I wanted to do. I thought it was my calling in life. I actually still think it was my calling in life. But, and we had $100,000 in student loans. And she said, what's wrong? And I said, I don't know, but I can't do this. I'm not helping people. I'm just giving them drugs. You know, spending 5 minutes with them and giving them a drug that's not treating their underlying cause of the problem most of the time. And I said, I can't do this for the next 30 years. She goes, what are you going to do? And I'm like, I don't know. So around that time, this patient had been bothering me to meet his chiropractor. And, you know, at that time in my career, I never referred to chiropractors. I would tell people, don't go. They're dangerous. I never knew what they did. Never knew their philosophy. Never met one before, but that's how we were trained. And in my lack of sleep and this anxiety, I saw him that day that I blurted out to my wife. And he bugged me again. He wants me to meet this chiropractor. And he said he helped him more than just, you know, adjusting him. So I called the chiropractor. I set up a meeting for the following Tuesday. And I remember I got home from work on Tuesday. I said to Allison, I'm going to cancel that visit, that dinner meeting with the chiropractor. It's a waste of my time. What's he going to tell me? It's just a chiropractor. And she said, that's rude. You already made this time. You can't cancel. It's too late. He's going to be there. And she, as I'm walking out the door, she told me to be nice. So I went to the dinner, and he knew more functional physiology and functional biochemistry than I ever did. He was very smart. He brought me a book called Healing with Nutrition by an allopathic physician, Jonathan Wright. And we became really good friends. And, you know, we were best friends after that. And his name was Dr. Robert Radke. And we started sharing patients. And, you know, he was talking about the biochemical pathways much differently than I learned them. I mean, to get into med school, you had to take biochemistry in your undergraduate college. And then you took it again in med school. I got A's in both of them. I thought I was new biochemistry. I thought it was easy. Basically, what I did was I memorized the answers and spit them back out in the exam. But I didn't really know what they meant. And I couldn't apply them to the patient in front of me. And here, this chiropractor, who before the meeting, I thought, what the hell does he know? It's just a chiropractor. This chiropractor's talking to me about how important it is that we should be looking at these pathways, and we should be looking at things that are disrupting them and things that are supporting them. And it was a whole paradigm shift for me. So based on what I learned at dinner that night, and I read that book. I took that book home and I read it till 2 to 3 in the morning. I had to work the next day. I got up and I wasn't tired the next day. After sleeping a couple hours that time, I was charged up. And before I left for work, I called my dad and I said, hey, can you come in the office and draw some blood work? So based on what I read in the book, based on what I talked about with Dr. Radke, I drew two blood tests on my dad. I drew a thyroid level and his testosterone levels. And his thyroid level was in the reference range, but in the lower part of the reference range. And his testosterone level was read as less than whatever the lab test could read. So it was almost at zero, way below the reference range. And I didn't really know the relationship between testosterone and heart disease before that meeting with Dr. Radke and reading that book. And I didn't really realize the importance of thyroid hormone and heart disease, really, before reading that chapter in that book by Jonathan Wright. And I got the blood work back. I put my dad on two things, natural thyroid hormone and natural testosterone. And within 7 days of doing that, his 20-year history of angina went away, never returned. Called me up after day seven and said, I haven't used any nitroglycerin pills today, because he was using them like candy. He would do anything, and he's popping a nitro because he's getting chest pain. And now, during that time, my dad had those two heart attacks, and by the time I was 6 months into my practice, he had two bypass surgeries. He had angioplasties. He was on 12 medications to control heart disease, hypertension, diabetes. And he was popping nitros like they were candy every single day, multiple nitros. And he couldn't do anything because anything would cause him chest pain. So he said, I haven't used any nitros today. And I'm like, wow, that's good. And he said, I think I'm feeling better. And then I talked to him every day or two, and he just say he's feeling better. And 30 days later, I draw his blood work again, and his testosterone levels are where they should be. His thyroid levels are better. He's now doing things. He's no longer looking pale and pasty. He's got a pink color back to his cheeks. He can do things outside. He never used another nitro. Once I saw the changes in my dad, I went to the partners and I said, I don't want to be a partner anymore. And they said, what's wrong? And I'm like, I just want to go do holistic medicine. And they knew about my father's story, and they said, well, what's that? And I said, I don't really know, but I'm going to have to figure this out. And they said, why don't you do it here? And I said, no, I need to do it in an office where the people answering the phones are on the same page with me. The people pulling the charts are the same page as me. The nurses are the same page as me. I want everyone, the doctors, all the providers, thinking the same way. By that time, my wife's, I don't know, she's a month to delivering our first baby. I'm leaving this guaranteed, private practice thing. And, I said to, I was telling Allison about, I'm going to go do holistic medicine. She looked great. She just supported me all the way through. And it was not a concern at all. And the only concern I got was from my dad. He got all nervous. Like, you're giving up this partnership. They make a lot of money there. What are you doing? I'm like, I'm going to make it work. If I have to work in an emergency room at night, I'll work in an emergency room at night. But, I got to give this a try. And now I'm 30 years later, and it was the best thing I ever did. And medicine was a calling. This was the type of medicine that was a calling. And it's great, and I still like it. And it's hard work, and I'm still studying. I'm still learning what holistic medicine is, but I got a better, much better idea now.
As you can see in this episode, iodine is so important for our physical health because when we get the important bioavailable nutrients, our body can heal so many diseases. But a very common problem that we don't talk about is mental health disorders like anxiety and depression. And according to a recent study published in the Lancet Psychiatry, one in every two people will suffer from a mental health disorder in their lifetime. And that included me. There have been times in my life that I needed extra support. And more recently, it was from my dad's diagnosis of a terminal brain disease. And that's why I have BetterHelp as a sponsor of today's video. BetterHelp will connect you to a licensed therapist who is trained to give you unbiased, helpful advice. Whether it be a work, personal, or a family challenge, it can definitely be beneficial to have a licensed therapist give you objective, step-by-step approach to help you with certain problems. The best thing about BetterHelp is that you can do it all from your phone or computer via video call, phone call, or messaging. It is the easiest way to connect to a therapist, and they will match you with a professional that has years of experience helping people with struggles just like yours. So if you'd like more support, just head to betterhelp.com/5-minute-body or choose 5-minute-body on the sign-up page and get a special discount on your first month. You mentioned thyroid and low testosterone is connected to heart disease. How does that work?
So that was first described in 1898 in England, and of a patient developing heart disease from low from not having, you know, low thyroid. When doctors were just starting to use natural thyroid hormone to treat thyroid problems, and the doctor, you know, under autopsy, they were finding that people with low thyroid were having atherosclerosis or blockage of their major arteries. And so since then, there's you know, multiple hundreds, if not thousands, of articles documenting the correlation with hypothyroidism and the development of atherosclerosis. One of the first books I read after that meeting with Dr. Radke, what happened after that meeting with Dr. Radke and I saw my dad change, I'm like, I got to learn holistic medicine. After going to all these conferences, reading all these books, this was before the internet. This was in the early 90s. So one of the first books I read was Hypothyroidism, the Unsuspected Illness by Brodo Barnes. And he was a family doctor in the, he was near the end of his career in the 70s when the TSH test became, was brought out. And doctors went from diagnosing thyroid problems, particularly hypothyroidism clinically, to relying on a blood test, the TSH test, to make that diagnosis for them. So they really didn't have to do the clinical diagnosis. Before the 70s, doctors would do a good exam. They would palpate the thyroid. They would check the reflexes. They would talk to patients and listen to patients. Once the TSH test was sort of, wasn't mandated, but it was sort of taught to doctors that this is how you're going to diagnose hypothyroidism from now on, that this is a more scientific way to do it, doctors stopped palpating thyroids. Doctors stopped checking reflexes, and doctors stopped clinically diagnosing someone with hypothyroidism and relying on a blood test that misses it in a lot of people. So it's been known in animals, it's been known in humans that an underactive thyroid predisposes to atherosclerosis or blockage of the arteries and eventually heart disease and so on. So, you know, I saw that firsthand with my dad. And after treating my dad with those two hormones, every patient in my office gets a full hormonal evaluation and a whole nutritional evaluation. Every patient, I don't care what they come in for. So I started diagnosing a lot of thyroid problems in the, you know, from treating my dad. He was, I always say my dad was my first and my best patient. And the first 10 years of my practice, I was putting a lot of patients on thyroid hormone. I was clinically diagnosing it. I taught myself to use my hands to properly palpate a thyroid because I wasn't taught in med school very good how to do that. And I can tell you from having med students and residents rotate through my office, they don't know how to palpate a thyroid. I have two goals for med students that come to my office. One is they, by the end of 30 days, they can palpate a thyroid properly and get a diagnosis down to 0.5 millimeters of cysts and nodules in the thyroid. I can do 0.3 right now. And two is they can read an article and they understand statistics, how to read the articles. Those are my two goals. But anyways, they first 10 years of my practice, I'm diagnosing a lot of thyroid problems and putting people on thyroid hormone. And I would estimate that I had 3/4 of my practice on thyroid hormone. Now, patients were reporting they were better. Hypothyroidism can cause people to feel tired and fatigued and brain fog, and they can gain weight and get puffy under their eyes and their face, and they don't feel good, and they feel slow and they feel sluggish, and they come overweight and obese from it. So I'm diagnosing hypothyroidism. I'm putting 3/4 of my patients on thyroid hormone. They're reporting that they're better. Their clinical exams are better. However, I became, during that time period it was happening, I just didn't feel great about why all of a sudden am I having 3/4 of my adult practice on thyroid hormone. I didn't think we were designed by our maker, just because you're getting a little older, that everyone needs thyroid hormone. Even though my practice was growing, I thought I was doing good for people, and they reported they were feeling better. So I went to those, learning from Dr. Radke and, you know, my beginnings. I look at biochemical pathways every day, always thinking about them. What supports the human biochemistry or the human biochemical pathway that I'm dealing with a patient, and what can inhibit it? And how do you best support it? Because if you give the body its basic raw materials, it can do pretty cool things. So I would look at what are the cofactors needed to make thyroid hormone. in the biochemical pathways. And you run across things like selenium, magnesium, vitamin C, B vitamins, and you'd always run across iodine, always, because you T4, T3, the inactive and active thyroid hormones, you have four atoms of iodine attached to thyroglobulin and three atoms of iodine. You can't make it without iodine. So I started trying these cofactors in varying amounts, small, medium, large amounts, to see if I could just get people's thyroid working better so they don't need to take exogenous natural thyroid hormone. And nothing worked like thyroid hormone. I kept coming back to iodine. I would use small doses, medium doses, large doses. And not that anyone felt worse from any of this stuff, but very few people felt better, and it wouldn't change their thyroid function when I did my clinical exam and measured reflexes and things like that and palpated their thyroid and when I checked their blood tests. So I got frustrated, and I really got frustrated with iodine because iodine was a very difficult topic for me first 10 years because I just didn't quite understand it. And then around that 10-year mark, I read an article, it was just before 10 years, but I read an article in one of my journals about a doctor in California who developed an iodine loading test to measure iodine levels. Now, before that test, there was no good measure of iodine that I could order anywhere. I assumed people were low in iodine because I live in the Goiter Belt of the United States, one of the lowest iodine levels in the central United States around the Great Lakes where I live. And iodine, I assumed my patients were iodine deficient because our soil and water and food is so low in iodine. And I've been watching the government's numbers saying iodine levels were declining over the years. But I couldn't find a good measurement for them. So when he developed this test, I called him. He became interested in me right away because of my location. And he knew about the Goiter Belt of the United States. And we became fast friends. And I would fly out to California with a bunch of urine samples in my possession. And we started testing people. And he taught me more about iodine than, you know, he's forgotten more than I'll ever know. But his name was Dr. Guy Abraham. And he taught me the form of iodine I was using was the wrong form. And that's why I wasn't working in my patients. What I didn't know was that different tissues of the body preferentially utilize different forms of iodine, such as the thyroid gland primarily uses the reduced form of iodine, iodide. The breasts use iodine, the oxidized form. And different tissues use different forms of iodine. So if you want a whole body effect for iodine, what I found was when I started using a combination of iodine and iodide in the form of something like Lugol solution, that's when I started to see the results. And so I started testing my patients for their iodine levels with Dr. Abraham. I flew out to California, you know, which is a long flight from Michigan, you know, where I'm at. But I'd fly out once a month for a long weekend. We'd spend 12 to 18 hours in the lab, even though I hated it. I hated doing bench lab work. But he taught me how to test iodine. I put up a lab in my office and I was certified by him. There was only three labs in the U.S. at that point that could test people for this. And I was one of them. We started testing patients. I started writing about it and collecting the data and found that, you know, 97% of patients were low in iodine. And then when I started using the right form of iodine, then I started to see the results. And I went from having 3/4 of my patients on thyroid hormone to now less than 1/4 of them on thyroid hormone. I went from my average dose of thyroid hormone of 120 milligrams of natural thyroid hormone to 30 milligrams now, really solely just using iodine. The other cofactors didn't work like iodine worked. So now I have pretty much everyone on iodine. Like I said, less than 1/4 of the patients on thyroid hormone. And, you know, I think I'm doing a better job with it.
So the question is, what is iodine? And what does it exactly do in the cells of the body?
So iodine is an element. Iodine in the periodic table is in group 17 of the halides. So if you all recall from high school chemistry, or if you had it beyond that, if you're looking at the periodic table, it's over here on the right side, and it's in the halide panel. And that there's four common halides in our world. I'll do them in order of their size: fluoride, chloride, bromide, and iodine. And these halides are grouped together in this group 17 because they share similar properties. And in the human body, they can competitively inhibit one another. Now, what that means is if you get too much of one halide, it can push out another halide. Now, two of those four are essential for the human body. There's receptors, there's needs for them, and we can't live without them. Iodine and chloride are the two essential ones. The other two are toxic, non-essential things that we don't need to live and really have no known therapeutic value in the body. We can argue whether fluoride helps with dental cavities or not. The rest of the world seems to have figured it out, except for the U.S. But fluoride and bromide are the other two that I believe are toxic. They're non-essential because we can live without them, but they're also toxic halides that don't belong in our body, and they can mess with iodine receptors and competitively inhibit iodine, particularly bromide, because bromide's a much closer size to iodine. Then fluoride's very small. It's at the top of the halide list. So in my testing with Dr. Abraham, we were testing fluoride, bromide, and iodine levels. And what we found was the biggest competitive inhibitor of iodine was bromide by far. Fluoride was difficult for us to measure. It's a very small molecule. It's very electronegative, and it's very toxic. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of enzymes that become destroyed when fluoride becomes part of, fluoride interacts with the enzyme system. Bromide, on the other hand, can competitively inhibit iodine. I've shown that in my book. I wrote a book, Iodine, Why You Need It, Why You Can't Live Without It. And I show that in a couple of the studies that I did that, I did a study with breast cancer patients and non-breast cancer patients, and I found the breast cancer patients had 50% less iodine before I supplemented with them, just checking them in the clear, and 50% more bromide. And when I put them on iodine, the breast cancer patients took longer to get iodine sufficient, and they excreted a larger amount of bromide. And just as you would expect, because the iodine can competitively inhibit bromide, just like bromide can competitively inhibit iodine. The problem we've got in our world is our iodine levels have dramatically fallen. Rena, where do you live?
Right now, I'm in Portugal.
So I've done lectures in England. I've done lectures Turkey, and done lectures in Israel. Well, online for a couple of these countries. In England, I was in person. And I went to Australia, and I researched the iodine levels at these four countries. And they were the same problems the U.S. is having. Falling iodine levels, very similar to the U.S., falling iodine levels. Where you guys don't have as much a problem is fluoride and bromide. Bromide is used much more in the U.S., and fluoride is used much more in the U.S. than it is in Europe. We use bromide here as a fire retardant. It's in a lot of consumer goods. I mean, as a fire retardant, it's used in carpets and curtains and a lot of home things you build your houses with and your office buildings with. In the U.S., it's also used as a vegetable oil, brominated vegetable oil. It's used in some sodas, and it's used in flour and baking products. And I don't believe you guys use it quite as much as we use it, but you guys do have that same falling iodine level. And when I was in England, iodine levels are about virtually equal to the U.S. Australian iodine levels were virtually equal to the U.S. The largest source of iodine in the world is in the oceans, and we should be able to get iodine from ocean animals and ocean vegetables. The problem is our oceans become so polluted, the iodine levels in those fishes, those animals and those vegetables have declined over the years too. So I call this a double whammy when I give my lectures. We have a double whammy of falling iodine levels and rising toxic halide levels that are causing more problems, out there. And in those countries where I looked at it, I looked at Turkey. This is where I lectured: Turkey, England, Australia, and Israel. I found the same exact thing as we found here, those falling iodine levels, rising bromide levels, although they're rising here a little faster than what they are in Europe.
So when you think about iodine, and a lot of people think that iodine just affects the thyroid, it causes the cysts, then can lead to cancer. But as you said, iodine is needed for every single cell in the body. So where else is iodine needed? What other parts can an iron deficiency in the body be dangerous?
So every cell needs and requires iodine for proper function. So it's everywhere. The highest levels of iodine are in the fat tissue, the muscles, but iodine is needed in the neurologic tissue, in the brain, the liver, the kidneys, the everywhere, you know, the spleen, every cell needs and requires iodine. As I said earlier, it's concentrated against a gradient in the glandular tissue because you can't make hormones without iodine, any of the hormones, ovarian, testicular, thyroid, pancreatic, any of them. So there's a particular mechanism to concentrate it called, where they use a sodium iodine symporter. You can think about that like a little taxi cab that sits there outside the thyroid gland or the breast or wherever, you know, needs to be. And iodine comes from the bloodstream that it moves into the taxi cab, and the taxi cab drives it over the cell membrane and deposits it in the thyroid so you can make thyroid hormone. In order for that taxi cab to do that, it needs sodium, two atoms of sodium to do that. So you need salt. So I had realized, you know, as I started doing holistic medicine and looking for what these biochemical pathways, how do you optimize, how do you support and optimize biochemical pathways, and how do you poison biochemical pathways? And, you know, the pesticides, insecticides, herbicides, and a lot of drug therapies, you know, most of the drug therapies used in conventional medicine either poison enzymes or block receptors in the body. I mean, that's how they work. Very few of them support the human biochemistry. And I think we're in a big problem. We've got too many things in our modern world that are poisoning enzymes and blocking receptors. So to get iodine to move across the cell membrane, that sodium iodine symporter, that taxi cab, needs an iodine atom and two atoms of sodium. So people need adequate amounts of salt. So 30 years ago, when I start to do holistic medicine, I start to look at, well, what, you know, why are people such a mess? You know, what's happening here? And, you know, one of the first things that came to was, well, hell, they're dehydrated. You know, they're not drinking enough water. The major constituent of the body's water. You know, I always tell patients, forget everything else we talked about, whatever this hour visit was, and forget all the other supplements I'm telling you to take. If you don't drink water, you're not going to get better. You know, you're not going to reach your optimal health without drinking adequate amounts of water. So, you know, dehydration was a big thing. The second most common constituent in the body, I quickly realized, was salt. So, you know, I was taught in med school, don't have any salt. Any salt will cause hypertension. You know, we have too much salt in our diet, and that's the end of the salt story. Well, you know, I wrote a book on salt. I'm looking for it. I can't find my book on salt to point out to you.
You've written like 15 books, right?
I've written 17 books. Salt Your Way to Health was up there. And what I started finding was, when I checked chemistries on people, the vast majority of them were low, and they weren't optimal in salt. So the reference range for salt is like this big. It's too big. The reference range should be like this. They weren't optimal. So I remember when I really noticed this was in older patients, I would see these sodium levels of 130 milliequivalents per liter or less. And they were a mess. You could not get them better. And if they got a cold, if they got a minor something, they'd end up in the hospital from dehydration and from hyponatremia I realized, holy moly, salt is a big deal. I mean, you know, we just minimize it here because, you know, salt causes hypertension. It's all the Western world. I'm sure it's the same in Portugal. And so I started having people use natural salt, good salt, healthy salt. And what I found was their health improved with it and their blood pressure got better with it. When they got rid of refined salt, which has no minerals in it, it's just got sodium chloride and toxins like aluminum silicate and, you know, some other things in there that aren't good for us. You know, that's what's raising the blood pressure and that's what's screwing up things. When they put in regular salt, their blood pressure actually got better. I find most of my hypertensive patients are lacking salt. And when they get rid of refined salt and go on unrefined salt, they do better. And that's why I wrote the book, Salt Your Way to Health. So for iodine, iodine does not work well if they don't have adequate amounts of salt. So if I'm putting someone on milligram doses of iodine, I'm putting them on salt generally. Now, once in a blue moon, there's a salt sensitive patient where their blood pressure will go up, or they can get a little swelling or edema or something like that from salt. Man, those patients are few and far between. Maybe it's a patient every couple of years, but they're out there. There's a few of them. If you don't have congestive heart failure and you don't have renal failure, it's unlikely you're going to be salt sensitive and problems with unrefined salt, you know, taking unrefined salt as part of a nutritional regimen. I call this doing the basics. You know, doing the basics to me is Hydration. Don't let yourself get dehydrated. Salt is number two, since it's the second major constituent in the body. Make sure you have adequate amounts of salt. I'll throw iodine in there as the basics that, you know, every cell in the body needs and requires iodine. And exercise would be a fourth one. And then the fifth one is diet. They got to eat well, get rid of refined foods and eat healthy foods. I got books on all this stuff. And, you know, the books are easier for me to write because I just write about what works in my practice.
That's why you're truly incredible. So it's like the simple things that we're going to talk about. And we're going to talk about, I'm going to ask you exactly how much of each that we need. But let's circle back to iodine. So you're saying that we can't get iodine in foods. Is that right?
You, in our modern world, with our exposure to fluoride and bromide, and it's used in your country, in Europe as well as insecticides, herbicides, and pesticides. The iodine levels in food have fallen in those three European countries, whatever you want to consider them, you know, four close to European countries that I looked at. The same thing was happening there as it's happening here. And same thing with breast cancer rates. And, you know, it was the same thing. There was no difference with it. And autoimmune thyroid disease and thyroid cancer was going up at epidemic rates in these countries as well. It was the same problem. So look, the best solution would be, hey, let's get it from our diet. You know, I don't want to supplement people. You can't. It's impossible to get these in our modern world to make sure iodine's not getting competitively inhibited by bromide and fluoride. You just can't get enough in food. And the ocean has become polluted as well. And iodine levels have fallen in pretty much everything right now. So I would say an average dose of iodine is 25 milligrams for an adult, a little bit less for a kid. And if they have cholangio disease, breast, ovaries, uterus, prostate, pancreas, thyroid, they generally need more, you know, 50 milligrams and up. If they have cancer of those cholangioid tissues, more, you know, hundreds of milligrams sometimes. And now iodine shouldn't be used alone. It should be used as part of a holistic treatment regimen where I certainly wouldn't take 50, 100 milligrams of iodine without adequate amounts of salt, because when you start taking iodine in, if you're iodine deficient, you're bound to have bromide and fluoride just proliferating in the body. And you're going to mobilize that bromide and fluoride when you take iodine, and it's got to come out. And people can get sick from that. It's called a Herxheimer reaction or a detoxification reaction. And, you know, how do you minimize that from happening? Drinking water, you know, maintaining hydration, salt, eating good food, you know, not eating refined food, exercise, you know, all that stuff helps. It's all, I consider all the basics. So if I ever run into a problem with iodine, and it's not very often, you know, I'll tell people stop the iodine. They're complaining of like they're getting headaches or I don't know, you know, whatever iodines, they don't like iodines doing to them. I'll say stop the iodine, go on an extra teaspoon or two of unrefined salt a day for 2 weeks, try the iodine again. I'm telling you over 95% or higher of people who have problems with it can now take it, you know, once they help the detox pathways. And the salt's really crucial for that. In the old days, bromine was used in a lot of medications. It's still used today in medications. It's part of the chemical makeup. You know, some asthma inhalers and there's many brominated compounds out there, many fluoridated drugs out there. Antidepressants, you know, there's a whole bunch of them that contain these toxic halides. And so in the old days, we used to have, you know, you don't look old enough for this, but I can remember the commercials for Bromo-Seltzer. Do you guys have Alka-Seltzer?
No.
So Alka-Seltzer in the U.S., it's this tablet that you put in water and it bubbles, and for people who have heartburn, and you drink it down, and it's a antacid. They used to make it with called Bromo-Seltzer. Bromine would be a part of it. It was sold over the counter, and I can remember it. And you put these two brominated tablets in, and you drink it. Now, if there's anything more ridiculous than that, I don't know what it is. But people would become bromine toxic. And it was in the literature, and they would show up in the emergency rooms hallucinogenic, confused. And, you know, doctors would diagnose them with bromine toxicity. And the treatment for bromine toxicity was an IV of saline. They would salt the bromine out because the chloride, sodium combined with bromide, and the chloride would help competitively inhibit a bromide out, because chloride is a natural substance, has receptors all over our body, just like iodine does. So you can use iodine and chloride to get rid of bromide excess and fluoride excess. That's why salt and iodine are so crucial to be given together. I feel like I'm in the weeds right now and I can't remember what your question was.
No, that's okay. So it was the dosing, but just to make it very simple, if somebody is just like, right, I need more iodine, I don't have a thyroid problem, I don't have active cancer or any problem, but they should have iodine, how much should they have?
I would say for an adult, 25 milligrams a day is usually my average dose. Now, you'll get the best results with iodine as part of a holistic treatment regimen. You'll get the best results with iodine working with an iodine literate, you know, healthcare provider. And if you're going to use iodine, use something like Lugol solution or tablet of Lugol solution or a combination of iodine and iodide, and take salt with it. And if you have glandular disease, more. If you have fibrocystic breasts, which, you know, it's incredibly common these days. You know, birth control pills are, you know, bringing breast problems out, you know, more than ever in younger women. But if you have fibrocystic breasts, the treatment that's been known for 75 years that takes care of fibrocystic breast disease is iodine. I mean, that's been known all over the world. And we now know fibrocystic breast disease, which used to be considered a benign disease, is a precancerous condition. It's a precursor to breast cancer. And so if they have prostate enlargement or pancreatic cysts or, you know, any of them, you know, thyroid, ovaries, uterus, breast, prostate, pancreas, any disrupted architecture in those tissues, that I'll put them on maybe 50 milligrams of iodine. If they have cancer of those tissues, 100 milligrams. And all the while I'm using salt with it. You know, I always encourage my patients, make sure you have adequate amounts of salt. Sodium in the blood work should be 141 milliequivalents per liter or higher. Chloride should be maybe 103 to 105 milliequivalents per liter or higher. You know, lower than that, they're still in the reference range, but it's not optimal. And it's certainly not optimal when you introduce something like iodine and that can cause this bromide and fluoride to mobilize and become loose in the body.
So I have an interesting question for you. It might be a bit controversial. Now, iodine, you used to, when COVID was happening, so the viruses and all that, you used to recommend iodine, or do recommend patients take iodine to help with viruses. How does that work?
So I started this holistic practice 30 years ago, and flu season rolls around. And look, I'm going to conference after conference after conference and reading books. And conventional medicine, 30 years ago, there was nothing to offer for flu or colds or viruses, nothing. You tell people, go rest and hydrate and do you feel better and then go back to work. So there was nothing to offer. Of course, you know, if you get the flu, you know, your risk of developing pneumonia goes through the roof. So it'd be nice to have something to support the body up. So I started trying different things on people and came up with a protocol of using high-dose vitamin A. High-dose, when people are sick, you know, first sign of a sore throat or scratchy throat or fever or something like that. High-dose vitamin A, high-dose vitamin C, high-dose vitamin D, and iodine. And iodine was part of that protocol right from the beginning. And if I had patients on iodine and they got sick, I would just have them double their dose till they were better and then go back down to whatever they were on before. So the other thing I had people do is to nebulize a dilute solution of hydrogen peroxide and iodine at the first sign of anything or if they were sick. And if they needed more than that, I would give them IVs of hydrogen peroxide and IVs of vitamin C. And this was, you know, quickly into my practice, I kind of came up with this protocol. We treated people with this every year during flu season. You know, in the U.S., they report from 20,000 to 120,000 people die from the flu every year, or flu-like illness. Now, 20,000 to 120,000, let's take the, call 50,000 or 60,000 the median, 50,000 the median. Multiply that times 30 or 30 years of me seeing patients, there's a lot of people dying of flu and flu-like illnesses that we're not seeing in our practice. We're not sending our patients to the hospital. My partners and I cannot recall a patient we've sent to the hospital for flu or flu-like illness. None of us can recall anyone dying from flu, you know, during flu season. And yet, you know, these numbers are, we should be seeing something. You know, there's six of us practicing right now. So, you know, I developed this viral protocol and, you know, I just was doing it. And COVID rolls around. And, you know, I followed COVID from the minute that first report in China came out in December of 2019 of three atypical pneumonia patients with this novel SARS virus that they, you know, called SARS-CoV-2. And, you know, I followed it, followed the literature, followed, you know, first countries hit were China, and then it was Italy and Spain, I think, you know, were the next two. And, you know, I saw those pictures from Italy, you know, the refrigerator trucks and the morgue trucks sitting waiting to collect all the bodies. And then it came to the U.S. So comes to the U.S. and, you know, we were treating viruses for 25 years before this. Our patients didn't end up in the hospital. Our patients weren't dying. I thought we had something to offer here. So when COVID hit my area, which was one of the first areas of the U.S. it was hit, you know, people were calling me. They can't breathe. Their pulse oxes were really low. You know, you listen to their lungs. They had a distinct sound on auscultation when I had my stethoscope on their lungs that I've never heard with any other illness. And we started our protocol. We just, you know, I remember the staff wanted me to close the office. You know, right when COVID hit Michigan, there was a few cases in the air, and governor is shutting down our state in 2 days and saying everyone has to stay home. And the staff wants to stay home, some of them. And we had this meeting in the waiting room, and it's a tense meeting, and they say, when are we closing the office? I'm like, I'm not closing the office. We know how to treat viruses. We've done this for 25 years. I said, we've treated COVID or coronavirus because 30% of all viral illnesses are coronavirus every season. I said, I'm sure it'll, I said, I think it'll treat this fine. And I said, we're nimble enough. I remember using these words. We're nimble enough in our office. If this doesn't work, we have a lot of other things at our fingertips that we can go to with it. And I said, anyone who doesn't want to work doesn't have to work, but I'm working. And if I have to work alone, I'll work alone. And I said, I would appreciate some help, but I understand, and no one's going to lose their job. And we lost about 50% of our staff. The doctors held together, the nurses held together, and about 50% of my front desk stayed home. And so we started doing the work, and I started blogging about it and writing about it and, you know, wrote an article about it, and I ended up writing a book about it. And we used our 25-year-old protocol. We never deviated from it. And our patients, we had very few hospitalizations. We had one or two deaths early into COVID with it. That was it for the whole time period. Our death rate was tremendously lower. You know, our hospitalization rate was really lower. It worked as well as it did for the flu season, and we're still doing it today. And, you know, iodine was part of that protocol too. If they were on iodine, I just have them double the dose. And then I have them nebulize one drop of 5% Lugol's in three to five cc's of saline. It was 5 cc's of saline. And it's just been a wonderful treatment for it. We didn't use ivermectin. We didn't use hydroxychloroquine. We didn't use any of these other drugs. We just did our protocol with it. And it, you know, wrote a peer-reviewed paper on it. Of course, the government didn't like it. And, you know, had a mess on my hands with that. But, you know, that eventually went away. And we're still doing the same thing today.
So I don't know if I can ask you this question, but I saw on Google, like when I researched you, Dr. Brownstein, then it said warning letter. Can I talk about this? Is it okay?
You can all find it. Just type in my name and FTC letter or warning letter, and you'll be able to read the 6-page letter. Somebody spent hours and hours and hours watching me, what I was doing online in February and March of 2020. The hospitals were filling up around here. People were dying. The death rate was through the roof. We were working 12 to 14 hours a day. And at night, I'd come home and I would blog. And when I saw the patients get better, they'd come in with these pulse oxes in the 70s and low 80s, and they would do our therapy and get better. I would do like you and I are screen to screen here. I would do a video chat with them, say, hey, tell us about your illness. And, you know, I kept titling this, these blogs and these videos, there's still hope out there. 1, 2, 3, 4. There's still hope out there. 3, 4, 5. And at that time, there was nothing. Government was telling people, stay home, go to the emergency room when you can't breathe. Nothing you can do for this. And that wasn't true. There were things you could do. I wasn't the only one treating COVID. There were other doctors treating it too. And anyone who spoke up that you had a therapy that helped with COVID, they shut you down. So in right after I did this, I got up to like, there's still hope out there, 20, I think. I get this warning letter from the U.S. government, the Federal Trade Commission, saying there's no treatment, prevention, or cure of COVID. Therefore, any mention thereof falls in violation of federal code, blah, 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 blah. And if you don't take everything down in 48 hours, the U.S. Justice Department's going to kind of, you know, you'll hear from the U.S. Justice Department. So, you know, I contacted a few lawyers. I contacted, you know, I posted that letter right when I got it. So I'm not hiding from it. And I couldn't believe it when they sent that letter, man. They went through, somebody spent hours and hours. It was single space bullet points quoting me. And so any prevention, treatment, or cure, I never said I had a cure for COVID. I said I was treating viral illnesses the same way I've treated them for 25 years. And patients were getting better. That's how I phrased it. And so a treatment is anything a doctor tells a patient to do. I guess a treatment is go home, lie in bed, and don't do anything till you can't breathe and go to the emergency room. You're sort of giving them a treatment of telling them to lie in bed. But anyways, you know, that happened. I took everything down. I haven't really blogged since then. And then I wrote a peer-reviewed paper about it, and I wrote this. And, you know, it's COVID, when I look back on the time of COVID, it's like a softball of misery and anxiety and excitement and fun. It was sort of all mixed into one thing where it was exciting and it was kind of cool to have something to offer. And it was really fun to see people get better when there was nothing out there that was, you were told, could make anyone better. And then, you know, the misery of just the stress of it. And, you know, I remember I didn't sleep for the first 10 days or so because I didn't know people were going to get better or not. And, you know, we were working outside in Michigan in March, which we're in a northern climate, and it was snowing and it was sleeting and it was, you know, 25 degrees. And we're doing it at night with flashlights so we could put IVs in their hands from the car because we didn't want them coming in the office at that point. And it was an event. But, you know, we got through it and we're still doing it today. And, you know, the therapy proved its mettle. And I'm really proud of that time period.
Absolutely. Another question for you. Do you think, I'm not going to say cure, but do you think that iodine, along with the vitamin A and all your natural remedies, do you think it can prevent cancer?
Well, look, if I knew what the prevention for cancer was, it would, you know, it would be a nice thing to broadcast. So I think that as part of a holistic treatment regimen, it's a good therapy. Do I think it prevents cancer? We know iodine deficiency sets the stage for cysts, nodules, hyperplasia, cancer. There are studies that show in test tube and in humans that, you know, when you give iodine, these cancer cells can revert back to normal cells. You know, I won't be so bold to say can prevent cancer or cure cancer, but I think it's the right thing to do. And I think that, you know, along those lines, iodine is very helpful.
Let's talk about warning signs of iodine deficiency. So someone could think, I know you said that 97% of people have it. So most likely you have it. Most likely I have it. And interestingly, your daughters were iodine deficient and they had Hashimoto's.
Well, their mother diagnosed that one at dinner. So, you know, here I was remember she was pregnant. Allison was pregnant when I made my holistic switch. So that was Haley. And then Jesse came a year later. So the kids are about 10 and 11 years old. We're having dinner. And the kids were, they were active. They were playing soccer and tennis and, you know, doing fine in school. And, you know, they were normal kids, but they were complaining of headaches and being tired. And I just kind of thought it was, you know, early teenage girl complaining stuff. You know, I didn't know. So we're having dinner. My wife, you know, says, hey, you think they got a thyroid problem? You know, and, you know, I remember I had this like spoon or fork full of food ready to go in my mouth. And I stop and I'm looking at her and then I look at the kids. And, you know, I remember I like slapped my forehead with my other hand. I'm like, you know, you might be right on this one. Maybe that's why they're complaining about all this stuff. So I hadn't drawn their blood in a long time. So I come in the office and they got raging Hashimoto's. Hashimoto's disease is an inflammatory problem, autoimmune inflammatory problem with the thyroid gland. It's going up at epidemic rates. And it's going up because of iodine deficiency. So I diagnosed this, even though some holistic doctors say that iodine causes autoimmune thyroid disease or worsens it. Well, if that's the case, then they need to explain why iodine levels have fallen over 50% over the last 50 years and autoimmune thyroid disease has gone up at exponential rates during that time period. But so I diagnosed them with Hashimoto's disease, and they're Hashimoto's hypothyroid at the time. I put them on iodine and a little bit of thyroid hormone, and I lecture about this. I have both their blood tests, and I show over the years as their thyroid antibodies go down, I raise their iodine levels up, and now they're 29 and 30 years old. Neither of them have signs of Hashimoto's disease. You know, they were, I guess I'll use the word cured. I don't like, you know, necessarily cured, but they don't have Hashimoto's disease now. And this is an N of two. And if your hypothesis is iodine causes or worsens Hashimoto's disease, well, this N of two blows it out of the water, because a hypothesis has to withstand all criticism. And this one says it's not true. So you come up with a new hypothesis, because that one isn't true. I've treated hundreds of patients with Hashimoto's disease successfully with iodine as part of that regimen. And many, you know, lots of them, you know, have no signs of Hashimoto's after a period of iodine, you know. And I got, when I lecture on it, I have a whole mechanism of how iodine deficiency causes Hashimoto's and how iodine treatment is the treatment of choice for Hashimoto's and why it is biochemically.
Let's talk about the 9 warning signs of iodine deficiency. I have 9 written here. Do you know 9 of them? I've got them written here. Don't worry. Fatigue is the first one.
You know, these are all, it's all hypothyroid stuff.
But people need to know it, because they're going to be thinking, right, do I have fatigue? Do I have unexplained weight gain? All these different things, because it's not so much obvious. Sometimes even people, you know, get their thyroid panels tested or TSH and everything, and they're not properly diagnosed. There's always questions like, should I take iodine? How much should I take? So this is just the warning signs that, you know, oh, okay, something could be wrong.
So conventional medicine, when I was in med school, they taught me to diagnose hypothyroidism by drawing a TSH level. I didn't have to talk to a patient. I didn't have to palpate the thyroid. I didn't have to check the reflexes. I didn't have to listen to them. All I needed was a TSH level. If that TSH was outside of the reference range and high, they got a thyroid hypothyroidism. You treat them with thyroid hormone. If it was in the reference range, they don't have it, give them something else. Well, I could tell you that's a lousy way to diagnose hypothyroidism. My kids both just went through medical school and finished residencies, and they're working with me now, and they were taught the same way. The only difference now and 30 years ago was they teach the younger doctors to draw a T4 level with a TSH level, where they didn't teach me that one. But this is a wholly inadequate way to diagnose a thyroid problem. After diagnosing my dad as hypothyroid, seeing the improvement he made with that thyroid hormone and testosterone, every patient got a full hormonal evaluation, as I mentioned earlier. So I look at every patient's thyroid, you know, in depth, and they need all the thyroid tests. They need a TSH level. They need a T4 level. They need a T3 level. They need a reverse T3 level. That's crucial to really diagnose thyroid problems. And they need thyroid antibodies. And, you know, when you do that with a proper exam and a proper test, you can properly diagnose thyroid problems. I wrote a whole book on that one too. And every cell in the body needs and requires iodine. Every cell in the body needs and requires thyroid hormone. Thyroid hormone is the main metabolic regulator of the cells. And so it's like a little, it gets the metabolic energy fueled up. So, you know, if you don't have enough thyroid hormone, people are tired. First complaint, number one complaint I hear is people are tired. They're brain fogged. Their brain doesn't work. They're cold because they're not producing enough heat. They're constantly cold. They're cold in the middle. They walk into an air-conditioned building, they're freezing like right from the beginning. And they're cold anyways. In the middle of summer, they can be cold. I'm not going to hit all 9 of your signs.
Depressed mood, dry skin, memory problems, hair loss, carb cravings, unexplained weight gain.
Hair loss. Let me tell you, hair loss. You know, I recognize how severe hair loss can be for a woman. I fully acknowledge it. I grew up in a household of women. I raised a household of women, you know, was an adult in a household of women, and I got an office with primarily women workers. I'm I know women. I know what women like to hear. I know what they don't like to hear. I know how they like to be spoken to. I know how they don't like to be spoken to. And I also know when a woman loses her hair, the world must stop spinning until you figure out why they're losing their hair and reverse that, because she can't stand it. Now, if a woman is in a car accident or some kind of accident and loses an arm or a leg, it's pretty tragic for her, but she'll survive and she'll move on with her life and live a full life. But she loses her hair, that ain't happening, man. So got to take that seriously with women. And women do not like to be told it's part of aging, or they don't like to be told, you know, weight gain is normal. You know, for TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, it's a hormone that comes from the pituitary gland in the brain and comes down to the thyroid and tells the thyroid, if it's high, you need more thyroid hormone to be released. And if it's low, you're producing too much, and it tries to slow it down. Where am I going with this? So TSH in the reference range. The reference range for TSH is about 0.5 on the low part to 4.5 on the high part. And the problem is, if TSH goes up 1 point from like 0.5 to 1.5, they're still in the reference range. A conventional doctor will say, you don't have a thyroid problem. Well, they're losing their hair. They're tired. They've gained 5 pounds. Their skin's puffy. They know they don't feel good. And, you know, what's a conventional doctor going to tell them at that point? Rena, what's a conventional doctor going to tell them?
If they have puffiness and weight gain?
The TSH went from 0.5 to 1.5, and they're tired, they're fatigued, they're brain fogged, they're a little depressed, they gain weight. What's a conventional doctor going to tell them? What's wrong with them?
Antidepressant?
Ah, very good. They're going to say, you need an antidepressant. Like they have an antidepressant deficiency syndrome or something going on. No, many times they got a thyroid problem, and the TSH is in the reference range, but went from here to here, 0.5 to 1.5. And there's been a study that showed for every 1 unit increment TSH gain, a woman will gain, I think it's like 5.8 pounds. So this woman starts off a TSH of 0.5, can go from 0.5 to 4.5, and she'll gain about 20 pounds and be told, you know, no, there's nothing wrong with your thyroid. You need an antidepressant, which of course makes your thyroid function worse. They got a thyroid problem. So our reference range for the thyroid is too big. It should be shortened up. You know, I give a whole lecture of, you know, a long lecture on thyroid and how to do it properly, or how I do it. And, you know, I always stop, and there's a point in my lecture where if it's practitioners in the audience, I always stop and ask them, everyone's a unique biochemical individual and needs to be treated as such. However, I could just sort of generalize everybody into one box here, even though I tell people don't do that. But I say, what's the optimal TSH level for most patients that you see out there? Hands will go up, and doctors will answer who are checking these levels and looking at them and trying to correlate with their thyroid. And the holistic doctors, conventional doctors, they're stuck in the reference range. They, you know, they don't care if you're in the reference range and about anything else. But the answers come around TSH of around 1.0. seems to be the most optimal, give or take a little bit. And I agree with that. And all the holistic doctors, and I've done this in Australia, I've done it in England, you know, we're all seeing the same thing. We're all feeling the same thing. And so just because your TSH is in the reference range, if it goes from 1 to 2 and you gain 5.5 pounds, go from 2 to 3, gain another 5.5 pounds, go to 3 to 4, now you're up 15 to 20 pounds and you don't feel good and your hair's falling out and you're puffy. You know, it's not that you have an antidepressant syndrome deficiency going on there. You could have a thyroid problem going on there. And so I would suggest for patients to find a doctor who's iodine literate, find a doctor who can think outside the box, think outside of a reference range for TSH level. And, you know, if you're not getting where you need to go and they're just throwing these antidepressants at you, look, I could tell people you need it. I could tell people, it's easy. You need an antidepressant. They'll usually retort back, I don't feel good, but I'm not depressed. It doesn't matter for a conventional doctor. They'll still give them the antidepressant. So we need to search for the underlying cause of the problem. And many times it's a hormonal problem, and many times it's a thyroid hormone problem.
Absolutely. And that's why people, I think they love you. I mean, if every doctor could be like you, can you imagine the world that we would have? First of all, we wouldn't have any pharmaceutical drugs. Let's just face it. Maybe very few. If it's this big, it would be this tiny.
You know, it's interesting. I prescribe pharmaceutical drugs for people. There's a time and a place for them, but I've prescribed so few. And sometimes at the end of the day, I think about it, like how many antidepressants did I write for a whole day here? And most times it's zero. Occasionally it's here or there, you know, that I write for one or, you know, or I continue a prescription for one. But when you get the hormonal system balance, when you get the nutritional system balance, when people do those basic things like drink water, eat good, exercise, they don't need antidepressants. They don't need anti-anxiety drugs. They feel better. Their brain works better. You know, they're, you know, we've conventional medicine has just created a mess. And, you know, we have these very suboptimal doctors that are out there. And, you know, I hear from my kids who just finished a residency when they're chief residents and they're training the younger doctors. It's just, it's pathetic what's happened out there. I mean, it wasn't like that 30 years ago when I was in residency. And look, I was a conventional doctor back then, but there was just, it was different. And, you know, they were, these doctors today are, they're not, the reliance on drug therapies wasn't 30 years ago, wasn't like it is today. You know, now it's, you know, bam, everyone gets put on antidepressants. Bam, everyone gets put on statin drugs. Everyone gets put on, you know, anti-inflammatory drugs or antacid drugs or something. You know, no one's treating the underlying cause of any problem. And, you know, I realized 30 years ago I couldn't practice medicine like that. It was just, you know, I remember I was devastated by it because that's all I wanted to be. Since I was a young boy, I wanted to be a doctor. And, like, you know, for lack of better terminology, I mean, it sucked. I remember telling Allison, this sucks. My day sucks every day. I'm not helping people. And I went into this to help people. And I'm not doing this for 30 years. I said, I can't do it. And, you know, luckily I found my path. And it's been a good path and it's been a good road. Even with the FDA FTC warning letter, which you can all read it. Just type in my name and FTC warning letter and you'll find it.
I was shocked when I said, like I said to my husband, I can't believe there's a warning letter right at the top of the Google search, which is so weird.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Here's my book on virus, you know, hosted approach. I'm pretty sure I put the warning, maybe I didn't put it in here. I know I have a reference to it. I put my peer-reviewed study in here. I didn't put the warning letter. But when I lecture from that book, I have that warning letter, you know, right up front. And, you know, I couldn't believe it. I received one of the first ones of those. And that warning letter came, it was on a Tuesday. It was during COVID. It was about April or May. It was whatever the date is in that letter. And it was a Tuesday night, which is my late day anyways. But since we were treating COVID outside, we would see patients during the day inside. And then we'd schedule all these COVID patients for IVs and evaluation outside at the end of the day. People would line up in cars and we'd have an assembly line inside making whatever we were making for them and, you know, putting in IVs or whatever we were doing for them. And so I walked in, it was after 9 o'clock. I got to the office at 7 a.m. and I had my jacket on. I remember I had, you know, two bags in my hand. And when I walk in our door, my wife works at a computer, you know, so as I walk in, I can see her. So her and my daughter, Jessie, who was in med school at the time, was living with us. We're looking over, Jessie was over her shoulder looking at the computer. They were looking at that letter, which I didn't know. So I walk in, I see their face, and I'm like, what's wrong? I thought someone had died. I saw their face. I thought something terrible had happened to somebody. And I said, is everything okay? What's wrong? And they're like, you better come in and sit down. And I said, tell me, what's wrong? Is everybody okay? Everyone's okay. Something happened? She goes, yeah, something happened. Come in and sit down. Take your coat off. And so I'm standing with my coat on, and I'm dog tired. And I said, just tell me. And she says, you got a warning letter from the FTC. I said, what FTC? The FTC? The federal FTC? And she said, yeah. I said, is it to me? She goes, yeah. And I said, to David Brownstein? She goes, yep. And I said, what do they want? She goes, they want you to take everything down within 48 hours about COVID. And I said, why? And she said, you got to see this letter. She said, she's a lawyer. Allison's a lawyer. She goes, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life, but you're going to have to read this. And so put my stuff down. You know, I just felt like the weight of the world just plowed on my shoulders. I felt old and, you know, and so I start looking at the letter and I'm reading it and I'm like, I don't understand this. I never said I cured COVID. And I made a point in those videos, if you can find them online. And I made a point of said, this is not a cure for COVID. This is a treatment for, it's a treatment for people sick with viral and bacterial illnesses. That's what and it's the same treatment we've done for 25 years. We're doing it for people sick with this viral illness. That's what I said. And so she said, well, they're calling it an advertisement for your practice. I'm like, I never said it was an advertisement. I said, I'm just trying to provide hope out there. That's why I titled it, like, you know, she knew about it. And she said, well, they're calling it an advertisement. I'm saying, it's not an advertisement. I'm just telling you what we're doing. The government said we should be reporting what we're doing. The government made that thing at the beginning of COVID. Doctors need to collaborate. And they put up a website where you could put in what you're doing. So, you know, we called a lawyer specializes in First Amendment in the U.S. and, you know, two lawyers, and spent a lot of money talking to lawyers, and they both, and a few other people, and everyone told us the same thing. Take it all down. If it goes away, you know, just go on and do what you're doing. She goes, if they come back after you, then you're going to have to go after them. So one lawyer said he wanted to sue the government. And he said, you got a good First Amendment case. It'll go to the U.S. Supreme Court. And he goes, I can argue in front of the Supreme Court. I'm a First Amendment lawyer. I would love to do this case, but I need a $10 million retainer from you. Yeah. So I said, well, I don't have $10 million. And he said, well, then I guess I would tell you, take it down and see what happens. And if they come after you again, you know, call me and we'll have to figure it out. And so that's what we did. And I still continue practicing.
I'm glad it all worked out for you. I mean, you know, I'd be like crapping my pants. I'd be like, oh my God. Even I was worried for you when I saw the letter, and that's like years ago. So glad it's okay now.
You know, one of my friends calls me. So I posted the letter. As soon as I got that letter, I put it right up on that was the last blog post I think I made, was that damn letter. And I posted it there. You know, I wasn't going to hide anything from people. And I posted it and said, I'm going to have to take everything down. And I really haven't blogged since then. One of my friends calls me and she said to me, she's a doctor. And she said, well, you're going to have street cred now, street credibility. And I said, like, you're saying this is a positive thing? She goes, oh, you're going to see it from the patients. They're going to think it's a positive thing. You're going to be badass, you know, with that letter. I said to her, you know what? I don't need to be badass. I don't need street cred. I just want to be a doctor. And, you know, just trying to help people by posting those. There's still hope out there. Because when I was posting that stuff, there was no hope, man. If you went to the ER and you got ventilated, there was an 88% chance you were going to die. And nobody wanted to go to the ER. You remember that. We all remember it. It was terrible. Doctors were... I don't fault the doctors. I guess we could fault a lot of things, but doctors were doing the wrong therapy in the hospitals. Nobody knew. Our patients were doing okay, but of course you couldn't. They didn't want it out there because they wanted to get their, you know, their vaccine out there. You know, and if there was any therapies that were used for COVID that were successful, they couldn't EUA the vaccines in the U.S. emergency use authorization, which is, you know, what happened, and, you know, what happened here. And we see how good that went, you know.
Absolutely. Well, this has been an encyclopedia on iodine and so many other things, which was talking about other things that's happening in your life. But thank you so much for providing all that information. And I think that people, if you need to know one thing from this interview, take some iodine. Take some iodine. Lugol's 5%. Start with like a few drops, 2 to 4 drops, or is that good?
4 drops is 25 milligrams. 2 drops is 12.5 milligrams. Those are both average doses for most adult patients in my office, and more if I put people on more if they have you know, glandular disease, as we talked about a few times.
Wonderful. And I'm going to link all your books in the description of the video, because 17 books, you've got to read them all so that people can find them very easy. But thank you so much for your time, Dr. Brownstein. And I'm sure we're going to see you very soon. Thank you for joining me on today's episode with Dr. David Brownstein, talking about the importance of iodine and its impact on thyroid disorders and cancer. Now, if you're learning from or enjoying our episodes, please feel free to hit the subscribe button. That's a zero-cost way to help support our mission of root cause healing. And if you also have a question or you have a potential guest in mind that you'd like me to interview, please feel free to leave that in the YouTube comments. I check every comment. And you can also follow us on our other social medias at 5-Minute Body on Twitter and on Instagram. Finally, if you'd like to learn more about thyroid disorders and how iodine and diet can help, you can also watch this video with Dr. Elizabeth Bright. I'll see you guys next week.